KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Oakland in the Temescal neighborhood.
Jack London Square.
Fruitvale.
Adams Point.
Grand Lake neighborhood.
Maxwell Park.
Coming up, an experimental housing model that lets homeless alcoholics keep drinking.
Even I, when I first read about it, thought, well, how in the world could you give alcoholics access to alcohol?
How could a so-called wet housing facility affect San Francisco's homeless population? Then we'll see what the city of Oakland is doing about the tent camps that have been set up around town.
For the first time in 20 years, more Oaklanders were concerned about housing, homelessness, and the cost of housing than were concerned about public safety.
New solutions to problems of homelessness today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. In this year's homeless count and survey, more than 40% of homeless people in San Francisco reported drug and alcohol abuse. The idea of safe injection sites, where IV drug users can shoot up in safe, supervised environments, has been gaining a lot of attention recently. But there's another experimental concept that's been struggling to break through for more than 5 years: housing explicitly for alcoholics, where they would be allowed to keep drinking. It's a controversial idea, but the data shows it seems to be working elsewhere. As KALW's Andrew Stelzer reports, some think it could make a dent in San Francisco's massive homelessness problem.
Traverse City, Michigan is a long way from San Francisco, but I wanted to see what an alcohol-friendly facility might look like, and this small town of 15,000 happens to be home to one, Dan's House. The first person I meet after walking in the door is Brian Dudley. He says finding this place saved his life.
Traverse City in the wintertime gets very, very cold. And some people die. Some homeless people die. And I was almost one of them. Probably would have fallen in one of the lakes or rivers over here and just went bloop. That's about it.
Dudley is 61 years old, and he's an alcoholic, by his own admission. But over the past year, he's reduced his drinking significantly.
Oh, I was drinking 2 12-packs a day. And half a gallon of vodka. But now, you know what I drink? Not too much. A 12-pack will freaking last me up, till tomorrow.
A 12-pack every day or two might sound like a lot, but if you do the math, that's a huge difference. So how'd he cut down so much? By living in a house full of other alcoholics.
And then we received a grant from a foundation to renovate the basement and add another bedroom.
Dan's House is an unassuming one-story home along a busy road. It houses 8 chronically homeless alcoholic men. I'm getting a tour from Karen McCarthy, who founded Dan's House back in 2014, and Ryan Hannon, Goodwill's local street outreach worker, who's here to visit a client.
So there's a couple bedrooms down here. And bathroom. Knock, knock.
We'll be in one right now because Dougie's in the bathroom.
Okay, I don't want to go into their bedrooms without their permission.
Two beds in each room, and that's a good thing because we can get 8 people in, but it's also a bad thing because it precludes us from qualifying for federal funding. Federal funding would require single occupancy.
The state of Michigan provided a startup grant, but now Dan's House bare bones operating budget, just $100,000 a year, all comes from supportive individuals and foundations. Walking through the kitchen, I see a pot of chili bubbling on the stove for lunch, but that's not where the action is.
We have this great thing called a garage.
It's kind of a man cave.
A man cave. Well, it's definitely the man cave.
I'm soon led out back past a garden with Detroit Tigers logos stenciled along the fence and into the heart of the community.
How's it going, everybody?
Good. How you doing?
Good. But we have to warn you, what goes on in the garage stays in the garage.
Oh, okay.
Telling the reporter?
Yeah.
The man cave looks a lot like a suburban teenage hangout. Old couches and easy chairs, posters on the wall. There's a bunch of guys in here drinking beer, smoking cigarettes, and marijuana. Medicinal, of course. Glenn Butler sips on a tall can of Natty Daddy malt liquor. He says back on the streets, he would have to chug his booze before the cops took it away, or he was forced to share with his friends. Not at Dan's house. The pressure to drink fast, which leads to falls and other health risks, is off.
It was a place that I could sit and, like they say, sit and have a beer and know that if I went and bought five or six and put them in my refrigerator, that I didn't have to drink all five or six of them. I could have one or two. And they were good and they were safe because everybody here respects each other's stuff.
This garage illustrates the housing first philosophy. That's a growing trend amongst experts in the quest to end homelessness.
Housing first essentially does not require that people are abstinent from any substances to attain and maintain housing.
That's University of Washington Associate Professor Susan Collins. She studied a similar facility in Seattle called 1811 Eastlake, which houses 75 chronically homeless alcoholics and allows drinking. Since its founding in 2005, it's become a national model.
This was the first Housing First effort that was focused on people with alcohol use disorders. Within the first year of operation, the Housing First model saved taxpayers about $4 million.
That savings came from fewer emergency 911 calls and trips to hospitals, shelters, and jails. And Collins says the people who live at the Seattle facility actually end up, on average, drinking less over time than when they moved in.
What the research unequivocally shows is that when we invest money in the health and well-being of our fellow citizens, everybody wins, right? So taxpayers save money, people's health improves, their substance use decreases, the problems they're experiencing decrease. They're able to retain housing and kind of, you know, become more stable parts of our community.
It's often a tough sell to neighborhood residents, so there's only a smattering of facilities like this all over the world. They're often referred to as wet housing, a controversial name that many advocates don't like. Some provide alcohol to the residents in doses. One in Canada even teaches residents how to distill hard liquor so that they don't do it wrong and end up accidentally killing themselves. So why hasn't San Francisco, where over 3,000 homeless people self-report drug and alcohol issues, gotten on board? For starters, there's still a pretty serious stigma about enabling drug and alcohol use, even amongst the homeless themselves.
Wet housing is where people can live at and drink alcohol. I don't understand that one. I don't think that's a good idea. I think because it's going to eventually cause chaos.
That's Marjorie Robinson. I meet her in downtown San Francisco, where she's in line with hundreds of others waiting to get into Project Homeless Connect, a semi-regular event where homeless or housing insecure people can access resources like healthcare, counseling, clothing, and food. And most of the people I interview are pretty skeptical about a facility allowing homeless people to drink.
No, I don't think it's good. Because first of all, I'm an alcoholic. Second of all, I know alcohol does to certain people.
I don't know. I feel like some people don't know how to handle their alcohol. So it's hard to give them the ability to have somewhere to drink.
No, I mean, who's paying for that? I mean, I'd like to sign up. If you can hook that up for me, I'll go sit in a house, get paid. Someone can pay for my housing where I can sit on my ass and drink all day. That'd be great.
Former District 8 Supervisor Bevan Dufty says he used to be a skeptic too.
Even I, when I first read about it, thought, well, how in the world could you give alcoholics access to alcohol?
But the more he learned, the more it made sense to try something different.
A facility that really would have 75 to 100 individuals would definitely have an impact. You would see a change on our streets having that many people safe and housed.
Dufty directed San Francisco's Housing Opportunity Partnerships and Engagement Initiative for almost 4 years and brought Mayor Ed Lee to visit the renowned program in Seattle, where Dufty says he didn't see people hanging out on the street at all.
You don't see the problems that even you see on some of our regular shelters where there are folks that are on the street and then there are people that are dealing to those people. It's just not like that at all.
According to San Francisco's Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing, the city does have 74 designated beds for alcoholics along with specialized treatment. But they are scattered across six different sites around the city, and federal funding rules make it hard to qualify. Advocates like Bevan Dufty say there's a need for the community and specific support that a central location can provide. He first tried unsuccessfully to create a 50-unit alcohol-friendly facility in a San Francisco church back in 2012. The concept almost made it into city legislation in late 2016, but it just hasn't gained enough momentum, according to Sam Dodge, who recently left his post as deputy director of the city's Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing.
It's certainly not the most pressing issue that I hear from constituents and from the Board of Supervisors.
Dodge says the city's giving higher priority to establishing safe injection sites, supervised places for IV drug users to shoot up. Plus, San Francisco's subsidized housing sites already have relatively tolerant attitudes about addictive substances. Residents don't automatically lose their beds at most city-supported housing programs just because of alcohol use.
Chronic inebriates have been successful in this housing, so we haven't seen the absolute need for a sort of special carve-out program.
But the Drug Policy Alliance's Laura Thomas, who lobbies on both city and state legislation, says that's all the more reason to move ahead with easily accessible, centralized housing created specifically to support alcoholics.
San Franciscans, as a whole, still want to try new things and still have that spirit of innovation and a desire to do something about homelessness.
Thomas's group commissioned a survey in 2016, which found 64% of likely San Francisco voters support housing allowing indoor alcohol consumption. She says San Franciscans want positive, compassionate solutions, but instead, political leaders generally offer options that criminalize the homeless, like the sit-lie ban.
I think that there's a lot of support for the idea here. I think the bigger problem is actually finding a program, finding a building where this program can be situated, given the intense demand for supportive housing and for affordable housing.
Given the housing crunch, convincing neighbors to open an entire complex dedicated to alcoholics on their block could be a monumental task. So for now, the idea isn't getting much attention. Back in Traverse City, Michigan, Patrick McConnell says that's a shame.
Every town of any size should have this option.
McConnell was living on the streets for 7 years before he moved into Dan's house. Now he's taking some steps to turn his life around.
I just recently got out of a treatment center. I went to check myself into a treatment center in northern Michigan. And that was just something that I knew I had to do for myself. Now, would I have done that while I was living on the streets? Probably not.
Traverse City's mayor and police chief are now on the board of directors. The success of Dan's House and similar projects elsewhere will likely keep the idea on San Francisco's radar. I'm Andrew Stelzer for Cross Currents.
KALW collaborated on that story with the San Francisco Public Press. Find a link to their fall edition, which is all about creative solutions to homelessness, at KALW.org and click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. We'll turn now to the East Bay, where a countywide survey in Alameda reported that homelessness has increased by 39% over the last 2 years. While the underlying issues can't be eliminated simply and quickly, the city of Oakland is trying to alleviate some of the problems within the growing number of encampments. One short-term response is the city's plan to build safe havens, sites where homeless residents can camp securely and have access to portable toilets, sanitation services, and regular garbage pickup. To better understand this plan, KALW's Ben Trefney spoke with Joe DeVries, assistant to the city administrator, who's involved with the city's homeless initiatives.
So in response to the surge of homelessness that's been happening and has been documented, the Oakland City Council approved funding to create safe havens on city-owned land. What's the idea behind those kinds of legal campsites?
So the idea is it's called a safe haven in the staff report, but we're actually calling our first one the Outdoor Navigation Center. And it's a place where we can navigate people out of an encampment into housing. It's similar to the San Francisco Navigation Center model. The difference is we're doing it right where an encampment exists. Actually, our first one is going to be up and running fairly soon at 6th and Castro, where we had a vacant parcel. We actually entered into a lease agreement. We were successful in getting some philanthropy to cover some of the costs in terms of the site prep. But we're going to be putting in tough shed structures that two people will live in each shed, so up to 40 people at a time. We'll have a full-time case manager, a full-time site manager, and we'll provide people the wraparound services they need as they transition into housing. The thought is up to 40 people at a time will live there. And the length of stay will be up to 6 months. The hope is that some people will get transitioned into housing very quickly. Others will take a little bit longer. And we expect that some people won't make it. You know, we don't expect a 100% success rate. But it's an opportunity to really provide people the wraparound services right where they already are to get them ready for housing.
So what did you like about the San Francisco model of navigation centers, and what did you see as ways to improve? Obviously, if you're going to bring the services to where people are already camped out, that is one major difference.
That's correct. And it's a really low barrier model. People come with their pets, their partners, and their possessions. We actually are building a dog run at our first site because we recognize that the old shelter model, where people have to check in the morning and check out at night, they sleep in a big room, they don't have any personal storage, they might have a pet that immediately denies them access. We realize that those were barriers that kept people homeless. And so by eliminating those barriers, by saying, look, you're going to get a room, you're going to have a roommate, so you'll have one person, but you're going to be able to lock the door. We're going to have storage for you on site so that you don't have to check out and check in every day. And if you have a pet, then, you know, bring them along. I think that's really, really helpful to meeting people where they're at. Oh, also, they can come and go 24/7, just like you could from your own apartment or house. You know, although the site is monitored to make sure that it's secure, to make sure that new people aren't moving in who aren't supposed to. Certainly, for the people who are residing there, participating in the program, they have those come and go privileges just as they would anywhere else. Again, this is not a solution. This is just one part of the solution to the homeless encampment problem. There's a lot more that we're doing, and I'm sure you probably want to ask me about that as well.
Well, yeah, go ahead and tell me about some of the different things that you think are most effective at this point.
Well, from an encampment management strategy, what's most effective right now is that we provide, we're already up to about 8 or 9 sites where we're providing porta potties and wash stations so that people have sanitary facilities. That in and of itself just creates dignity for the people that are encamped. And also people have a place to go to the bathroom and to wash their hands. We can prevent the spread of disease. At those sites, we're also providing regular garbage pickup. We're also evaluating each encampment based on the impact it's having on the community. We look at things like, are sidewalks on both sides of the street blocked? And if they are, we will work with our law enforcement partners and our outreach providers to suggest that we get people to move to one side of the street and leave the other side free and clear for ADA accessibility and for safety's sake, for traffic. Sometimes we have to close them. We have to tell people you can't be here. But mostly right now, instead of pushing people around from block to block, mostly we're managing them by trying to reduce the garbage, provide sanitary facilities, and of course, on the front line, providing the outreach workers and housing navigators to get people ultimately navigated into housing.
That's Joe DeVries. He's assistant to the city administrator in Oakland. So I'm wondering, if you are providing services to encampments that have come up as a result of the housing crisis or homelessness crisis, then are you receiving pushback as a city from people who want to see them just gone? In San Francisco, for example, they have done a lot of different models, and part of that is just to basically get rid of the tents and have them move someplace else. Is this happening in Oakland? Because they really are in a lot of locations.
Of course, we do get pushback. people do not like seeing an encampment in their neighborhood, and that's why we try to take into consideration how to minimize its impact to the best of our ability. The fact is, the recent point in time count shows that 83% of the homeless in Alameda County were housed in the very neighborhood where they're homeless. And so these are our neighbors who have lost their housing, and so they have community roots, they have connections, and they're not going away. And then the development of affordable housing, of course, is crucial. That's really where the solution is.
So with one outdoor navigation center opening up at 6 and Castro and then some others to follow, what's going to happen to the other significant encampments in the city, the ones that have kind of become more permanently a part of the landscape there? What's the plan for those?
Well, the plan is to seek funding for more outdoor navigation centers, and we're looking to our partners at the county, we're looking to private philanthropy, and we're really hoping that as we get this first center opened and people see its success, that they'll really line up and want to get involved. Another pilot that we're doing, we've reached out to the Alameda County Interfaith Council. A lot of churches and other houses of worship that want to do more to help out, we're suggesting that we could have them really help us with a safe parking model. So instead of the safe haven for people living in tents, the idea is that church parking lots could be used to allow people to park their vehicles for those who are living in vehicles. 6 days out of the week, the church parking lot is pretty empty. And then on that seventh day, people could move out for the day. And then when the church is parking lot is available, they could move back in. We've looked at really successful models in Santa Rosa and Santa Barbara, as well as Seattle, that have relied on the faith community and the land that they own to help manage the RV population, if you will, or the vehicle population. And honestly, we are not going to solve this problem alone. We're going to be relying on our healthcare partners, our faith partners, our other governmental partners, and we really need to rely on private philanthropy as well to get ourselves out of this problem.
For people who are listening, who are living in Oakland or living in San Francisco or another place, and they see these encampments, What would you suggest to them to think? Obviously, people are giving calls to ask the city to do something about it. What do you think is the best response for people to have if they see people living in this kind of situation?
Well, first, I think people need to know that we are doing a lot, even though it doesn't look like it. When you drive by one of these encampments and you see the garbage piled up, you might think that the city does nothing and doesn't care, and when in fact it's our highest priority. Truth is, in a budget survey done this past spring, for the first time in 20 years, more Oaklanders were concerned about housing, homelessness, and the cost of housing than were concerned about public safety. And public safety was always the highest priority for 20 years until this past spring. So I think people know what's happening out there. Secondly, if you're thinking of donating things at encampments, we really want to encourage you not to. What's happening is encampments are becoming targets for illegal dumping. People are dropping off furniture, used clothing, perishable food, and what that's doing is actually making it worse. It's creating debris, and it's attracting rats, and creating a more of a health hazard. And so we really encourage people, if they want to donate, if they want to help out, is to go through normal channels like St. Vincent de Paul or Goodwill or anywhere else where you donate. We work with those organizations, and that's, in fact, St. Vincent is where we're having our winter shelter. And then last, just I think be patient and compassionate. Whenever somebody just says, get rid of these people, and they sometimes use not so nice language to describe them, I try to ask them to walk in the shoes of them. If you lost everything, if you lost your home, and all of your possessions were in a couple of shopping carts and a tent, you'd want us to be a little more compassionate as well. And as we sort through this and as we seek the resources to be successful, it is going to take time.
That's Joe DeVries, assistant to the Oakland City Administrator. He spoke with KLW's Ben Trefney. That piece was produced by Marisol Medina Cadena. And the rest of the Cross Currents team for today includes Raquel Maria Dillon, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Christine Nguyen, Stephen Short, Lilia Vega, and Josh Wilson. Our engineers are Jackie Sajiko, James Rollins, and Gabe Graben. The line producer is Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. you're interested in hearing some holiday jazz, Nicholas Beard and Friends have their 11th annual seasonal concert scheduled. You can hear them Saturday at the Piedmont Piano Company in Oakland. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
And your smile hold a strange invitation. Somehow it seems we've shared our dreams, but when time after time in a room full of strangers, out of the blue, suddenly you are there. Of temptation, glancing my way.